Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, Obama seeks to pave a long-term path for a U.S. rebalance toward the Asia-Pacific. Controversy over the nominating of a new U.S. Supreme Court justice. An author speaks with us about the philosophy of science. And there's exciting news about superstar Mariah Carey.
She is, without question, the ultimate diva in music. She's won 5 Grammys, 19 Music Awards. She was the artist of the millennium.
It's right here on the Voice of America. U.S. President Barack Obama will seek to solidify America's leadership role in the Asia-Pacific region for many years to come when he hosts all 10 Association of Southeast Asian Nations at the historic Rancho Mirage Retreat in Sunnylands, California, on today and Tuesday. White House correspondent Mary Alice Salinas is there and has this report.
The agenda at this picturesque site will be less formal, but leaders will tackle a range of critical and thorny issues central to the strategic U.S. rebalance to the Asia-Pacific. The U.S. sees its engagement with ASEAN countries as critical to its future security and prosperity. Southeast Asia is experiencing explosive growth and rising tensions. That's why Obama will urge leaders to adopt a set of rules and principles that will ensure each country can pursue its interests legally and peacefully. Daniel Russell is the Assistant U.S. Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs.
And a cohesive ASEAN helps secure stability and growth. It's built around a common commitment to rules and to fairness. It allows major countries like the United States, other powers, to engage constructively as partners. It prevents Southeast Asia from becoming a sphere of influence or becoming a battlefield.
The White House describes the region as the heart of the Asia-Pacific and ASEAN as a good forum to build an infrastructure to handle a range of issues. One issue, creating some of the greatest tensions, territorial disputes in the South China Sea, one of the world's busiest maritime waterways. Deputy National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes.
There are going to be different claimants. We don't have a claim. So our national interest is in seeing claims resolved consistent with established international law, because otherwise it's the law of the jungle and it's one big nation bullying a smaller nation, and that's how you lead to a cycle of conflict, which is in nobody's interest.
The White House says it will make clear it opposes what it says is China's militarization of disputed territories and that the U.S. will keep conducting freedom of navigation exercises there. The U.S. hopes to deepen trade and commercial ties, hoping to tap into the region's robust economic growth. Again, Ben Rhodes.
You see countries evolving into economies that are more service sector driven, that are driven more by entrepreneurship and intellectual capital and technology. And these are places where the United States can really add value.
The summit will also include talks about problems like violent extremism, cybersecurity, and climate change. Administration officials say by hosting the ASEAN summit, Obama hopes to develop a work plan for his final year in office to further the rebalance effort. And he hopes it will also send a message to future administrations that the same high level of engagement is needed for the U.S. to secure and maintain its leadership role for decades to come. Mary Alice Salinas, VOA News, Rancho Mirage, California.
Turning to what's buzzing online, our social media reporter G. Abby Lee joins me to bring us the latest on a YouTube celebrity. Hi, G. Who are we talking about today?
Hi, Susan. Her name is Michelle Phan, and you may be familiar with her if you're into makeup and watch YouTube videos. She has been posting makeup tutorials on YouTube from 2006, and since then, she uploaded more than 350 videos and received more than 1.1 billion views. She also has more than 8.3 million subscribers. She has been doing pretty well, with the Forbes magazine picking her as one of the 30 most influential people under the age of 30 in January.
That's huge, but why did she make headlines this weekend?
Absolutely, because of an article titled, "Why Michelle Phan is Starting Over" by Mashable. Now, the starting over is not about her YouTube career. She started out on YouTube, but after gaining a loyal following, she was able to build a beauty empire.
I see. Tell us about a couple.
She has a lifestyle network called Icon and a beauty subscription service called Ipsy. She also partnered with L'Oreal to launch her own line of cosmetics called M. The monthly subscription box Ipsy is doing pretty well, but M, the makeup line, is an utter failure. And the comment section under Mashable's Facebook page reflects that.
Ouch. What did people write?
First of all, many comments by male readers were, "Who is that?" But female readers shared their feedback on her businesses. Here's an example. "I was not a fan of the M brand, not impressed with the quality at all. Hope she can turn it around, maybe have a chat with Sam and Nick over at Pixie Wu. Real Techniques seems to be doing well." So that comment is in relation to another YouTube account called Pixie Wu, run by two sisters, Samantha and Nicole. They created a makeup brush line, and that's doing really well, unlike Michelle Phan's company. The latest news is that she bought the company M from the makeup powerhouse L'Oreal and is looking to revamp it the way she wants to. So as you can see, successful YouTubers make money not only from the viewing and the advertising, but also by utilizing their personal brand and building other businesses. Susan?
Thank you, G. You can follow her on Twitter at GAbbyLee or through our program's account at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
An international team of scientists was able to find hundreds of nearby galaxies that had been hidden by the dust and stars of the Milky Way. This gave them some new insight into a mysterious astronomical anomaly some 150 million light years away. Writing in a new study, the group says a third of the 883 galaxies they found behind our home galaxy have never been seen before. The study's lead author, Lister Stavely Smith, from the University of Western Australia, said that while the Milky Way itself is very beautiful and interesting, it completely blocks out the view of the more distant galaxies behind it. The scientists say their discovery may also help explain a phenomena called the Great Attractor, which is described as a region of space that seems to be pulling ours and hundreds of thousands of other galaxies toward it with a gravitational force that's tens of thousands of times more powerful than that of the entire Milky Way. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Now, this will be a subject of the next presidential election, which is what the Constitution...
The body of 79-year-old Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia was being returned to Washington from Texas, where he unexpectedly died of natural causes at a ranch resort Saturday. Scalia, who served for nearly 30 years on the nation's highest court, was known as a strong advocate of the original meaning of the nation's nearly 230-year-old Constitution, in his opinions. But the political debate over his replacement is already underway, as it comes during President Obama's final year in office and during a heated political campaign. Mr. Obama insists he has the duty to send the Senate a nominee to confirm, but Republicans, who control the Senate, are mindful that Scalia's death evenly divides the nine-person court between liberals and conservatives. Many of those running for the Republican presidential nomination say the next justice should be selected by a new president next year after the election. Randy Barnett, a professor of constitutional law at Georgetown University, tells VOA's Victor Beatty, without Scalia's presence, the remaining eight justices will likely move to the left on some of its rulings.
Now, this will be a subject of the next presidential election, which is what the Constitution contemplates it would be. It's a political question, who the president nominates, who gets to be the president who nominates, and now this will be the subject of the election. It would have been the subject of the election anyway, but this really focuses the mind of both the candidates and the voters, because there's a real vacancy that's going to have to be filled.
President Obama has indicated he will put forth the nominee to the Senate when it reconvenes after this President's Day recess.
The president is within his rights to nominate someone, and the Republicans are within their rights either to consent to that person or withhold their consent for whatever reason they deem appropriate. The Constitution establishes a political process in which a politically elected president makes a selection, and a politically elected Senate decides on what to do about that selection. And they're allowed to take all kinds of considerations into account when the president nominate someone, select somebody, he'll take a lot of considerations into account, and the Senate should also take considerations into account, including the future of the direction of the court.
Randy Burnett says even if a new justice was confirmed this year, his or her impact would be minimal at best, since the current court term ends in June and the next doesn't occur until October, 1 month before the presidential election. That's why he believes the voters should have a say in this crucial decision. Brandon Garrett, a University of Virginia law professor, says it is important to get back to 9 justices sooner rather than later.
You know, there's an odd number of justices on the Supreme Court for a reason. There may be any number of incredibly important cases that will come up to the Supreme Court even this term. And without a 9th justice, 4-4 decisions by a split Supreme Court will result in lower court rulings standing, no matter what the lower court said, right or wrong. And so liberals and conservatives may both be quite upset that there will be lower court opinions that cannot get reviewed at the Supreme Court, or if they do, it'll be stuck 4-4. And so incredibly important for everyone that there be a 9th justice, a tie-breaking justice, when there are so many evenly decided important decisions in this country. Now, a lot of days left in Obama's presidency. I can't imagine that he won't appoint people that could be palatable on both sides of the aisle. And I think it's a real risk if folks in the Senate decide that they want to try to obstruct an up or down vote on a Obama nominee. It's a risk that for conservatives, for example, that the next president might not appoint someone even less middle of the road or even more liberal.
The death comes in an election year, and is it really going to be up to the people in November to decide who will be on the Supreme Court?
Well, I think it was up to the people several years ago when they elected Obama. It absolutely was actually an election issue the last time Obama was elected, because people understand that there have been some justices that might be retiring or that are elderly. And so, Obama ran saying, I'm going to be putting people on the court that believe in a constitution that can be adapted to our times. And he won. I think he absolutely has had the mandate for the last 3 years to appoint justices that he thinks are the right type for the country.
And Brandon Garrett says whatever happens, the Supreme Court without Scalia will never be the same. With 8 justices for now, the court faces many important decisions, including on matters related to immigration, religious liberty, voting rights, racial preferences, and abortion. In the event of a 4-4 tie, the decision of a lower court will stand. Coming up on International Edition, a look at a basic approach to science, and singer Mariah Carey is getting hitched. Scientists are on a voyage of discovery, but to set out on that trip, it's best to have some foundation for your thinking. That is where understanding the philosophy of science can help. There is a new book out called The Meaning of Science, An Introduction to the Philosophy of Science. And its author, Tim Lewins, joins us on the line from Cambridge. Welcome, Tim.
Hi, it's a great pleasure to be here.
Oh, thank you so much. Perhaps in layman's terms, you might explain to us, what is the philosophy of science?
Okay, so the philosophy of science is a subject with a very long history. People have been thinking in broad and deep ways about the sciences ever since the ancient Greeks, but the philosophy of science deals with a whole bunch of conceptual issues around science. Questions like, how do we tell the difference between real bona fide science and pseudoscience? Questions like, are there good reasons to think that the sciences really tell us the fundamental truth about the universe, or do they instead just give us some useful set of tools for calculating likely predictions that we might make about the observable world? A whole bunch of questions like that.
Well, how can we use this understanding?
Okay, so I think that the philosophy of science has quite a lot of fairly profound practical implications. So, for example, it makes a big difference as to the way in which you think about, for example, the scientific standing of homeopathy or the scientific standing of intelligent design theory makes a big difference to the kinds of things that our taxes should be spent on, and a big difference to the things that our kids should be taught in school. And that immediately raises a series of philosophical questions. How are we going to tell whether or not these scientific views are real science or not, or whether they're instead some kind of pseudoscience. I also think the philosophy of science is useful when we come to ask questions about the role of bias and objectivity in science. And that turns out to be very important when we think about the ways in which scientific advice is put to work in formulating policy, for example. So I think there are a whole bunch of ways in which, at the same time as offering a fairly abstract theoretical set of questions, the philosophy of science also has some real practical impact.
Could you give us some examples of where it could be used in the political and government sectors of our society?
Yeah, so it's often the case, for example, that when governments seek advice on new technologies, that might be anything from new reproductive technologies to new technologies for exploiting energy resources, it's often the case that they'll call on scientists to provide what's often thought to be a completely objective, entirely value-free assessment of whether or not it's right to go ahead with the new technological direction in question. And I think there are quite a lot of reasons to be skeptical of the idea that, at least when scientists are involved in providing policy advice of that kind, there are reasons to be skeptical of the idea that they can really provide an analysis that's entirely free of values. And I think there are a whole bunch of reasons to be skeptical of that idea. One is that science is always uncertain. Scientists never know for sure what the future holds. They never know their theories for sure, just with various degrees of probability. And so that means that there's always a question, have we got enough evidence to go ahead with the technology in question?
And the name of your book again?
The name of my book is The Meaning of Science, and it's an introduction to the philosophy of science.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Tim.
Thank you very much for your time.
This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Border Crossing's Larry London has joined me here in the studio with news from the music world. And today we're going to talk about super-duper star Mariah Carey, who Larry tells me everybody knows. Everybody knows that, Mariah.
There isn't a person on the planet other than you, Susan, who doesn't know Mariah Carey. 200 million albums sold. She is, without question, the ultimate diva in music. She's won 5 Grammys, 19 music awards. She was the artist of the millennium. She had a number one hit in every year of the 90s, only artist to do that. So, she's right up there with the creme de la creme.
So what's she up to now?
Well, I'm glad you asked. Uh-huh. There's some big news about Mariah Carey. It's not music news.
Oh.
I don't have music news today because Mariah hasn't had an album out for a little bit. You know, she put out an album in 2014, and that was her last new album, although I understand there's a plan for her to work on a new album sometime this year. But she's not in a rush because she's got a Las Vegas residency. She's performing regularly in a hotel casino in Las Vegas.
That's a good gig.
That's what everybody seems to be doing now. Jennifer Lopez, Celine Dion's been doing it for years, and so now Mariah's got her regular thing going on. But here's the news that's very exciting for Mariah Carey. She just got engaged.
Oh, congratulations.
Yes, that's right, Susan. It's her third marriage. She was once married to Tommy Mottola, who ran Sony Music at the time, and that marriage lasted a few years. Then she married Nick Cannon. They have 2 children together, Monroe and Moroccan, and got divorced last year. And now Mariah has moved down and found new love with a billionaire whose name is James Packer.
And the ring?
Oh, of course, and the ring, the 35-carat
diamond ring.
Woo! She can use that in her show to light the stage.
She does. As a matter of fact, it was a newspaper story in Las Vegas that the diamond ring stole the show and was distracting everybody.
Ooh, well, let's listen to one of her songs, Always Be My Baby. Nice to have you stop by the studio.
Thank you, Susan. It's always a pleasure to be here in the studio.
I ain't gonna cry, no, and I won't beg you to stay. If you're determined to leave, boy, I will not stand in your way.
Thanks for joining us today for International Edition.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
Today is President's Day in the United States, when Americans pause to honor their national leaders, beginning with the first president, George Washington. From the time of his death in 1799, his birthday, February 22nd, was marked unofficially. It formally became a national holiday in 1885. Over time, Americans also began honoring another great leader, Abraham Lincoln, whose February 12th birthday falls near Washington's. Official recognition of the two began in 1971, with a day honoring all presidents every year on the third Monday of the month. Washington won lasting fame for leading Americans to victory in the War for Independence from Britain. His popularity was such that he could have made himself a king if he'd so chosen. Some of the officers in his army, impatient with the democratic process, urged him to do just that. "Banish these thoughts from your mind," Washington said, and issued a stern reprimand to those who made the suggestion. He ordered the army disbanded, resigned his commission as commander-in-chief, and retired to private life. At the time, America was a loose confederation of 13 states. Over the next 6 years, Americans struggled to devise an effective federal government, but one that left important powers to the states. Many Americans distrusted the idea of a central government and feared abuses of power by federal officials, especially the president. At this critical time, Washington was the one person who most Americans were willing to trust. He was the unopposed choice to be the nation's first president. When he took office, the United States had a constitution, but its government was not yet organized. When he stepped down, the U.S. was recognized by the world's major powers. Washington put the nation on a sound financial footing and created an effective military to protect America's expanding frontiers. In revolutionary France, democratic ideals gave way to turmoil, terror, and repression. But in the United States, under Washington's leadership, revolution produced stable, democratic, and lawful government. By leaving office voluntarily after 2 4-year terms, he set an important precedent for all future presidents. He also oversaw a peaceful transfer of power from one elected leader to another, a principle vital to democracy and an example for peoples around the world.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.